All right, welcome to another episode of Crossing Home Plate. I'm glad to have again with me Chris Davis, co-founder of College Baseball Fellowship. We'll start with that.
Yeah.
And then 13 years in the bigs and maybe did a few good things there along the way.
Yeah, you can Google it.
Glad to have you. And with us today, another kind of founding member of College Baseball Fellowship and 10 years in the majors, most of those with the Rangers. And many thanks for bringing our first World Series appearances there, being part of those 2010, 2011 teams and broadcasting now with the Rangers and all kinds of good stuff. So
that's right.
Welcome, David Murphy.
Yeah, good to be here. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yes.
Oh, we're super happy to have you here. And I think as Chris and I were kind of talking about College Baseball Fellowship and, you know, Chris had brought up your name early on and said, man, David's on board. But the funny thing is, as I talk to different people kind of around our area and things like that, they're like, man, you got to get Murph on. Yeah. You got to, I'm like, he's on. I just hadn't met him personally yet. So I promise he's in. And that just kept coming up. And again, I said this to Sean last week, your chaplain down at Baylor, Byron Weathersby, was like, man, you got to get Murph in there too. And so we're excited to have that, have you on. So, man, let's just kind of start with just growing up. What was kind of life like and maybe stop at that time you get to Baylor? I've got some specific questions around there, but let's start there.
Grew up in Northwest Houston. I was fortunate enough to have just a ton of consistency. You know, you hear so many stories of kids moving all over the place. Basically was in the same general area my entire life. Lived in a house the first, I guess, 3 to 4 years of my life. And then, and I was the youngest of four by far. I have a brother that's 13 years older than me. My sisters are 9 and 7 years older than me. So I was the baby. We moved a few miles down the road when I was four. And that is the house that today my parents still live in. So when I go back home, I'm actually going back home tonight.
Okay.
And get to go to that same house that, that I grew up in. And a lot of consistency there. Great friend group. From the outside looking in, average, normal, what you would, middle class American family. And baseball was it from the very beginning. My dad always told the story. He got me a Nerf ball and bat for maybe one of my first few Christmases and just took it and ran with it. I loved it from the very beginning. We dug up some old home videos, like the really old home videos from back in the day. Of me just, tossing the ball up to myself, letting it bounce on the driveway, and then just hitting it. Those are some of my earliest memories. Loved the game from the beginning.
That's great.
That's awesome.
So through high school down in the Houston area, and then, obviously that had to have gone pretty well.
Yeah. I guess it's funny, like looking at kids and the way that they play these days. I believe the first time I really remember playing select ball was at 14 years old. Yeah. And I want to say we probably played 80 games in that season, which was a lot from spring till the end of the summer, and started traveling a little bit more and took that, ran with it into high school. I made varsity as a sophomore, but as a pitcher. So I only got eight at bats that season. And, we ended up winning state. So I made varsity as a pitcher. I started the season on JV. And then I get called up because our number two pitcher had failed. It didn't make grades. Well, by the time that the district season is winding down, that same pitcher, he comes back and I was starting to perform poorly. So I had a good season, but I started performing poorly at the wrong time. So I didn't get to pitch in the playoffs. We go on to win state. So that was a cool moment. Junior year, I actually broke my arm throwing a pitch, fractured my elbow. And then senior year, we didn't even make the playoffs. But by that time, you know, my future was there. I had signed a letter of intent to go to Baylor. Actually did not want to go to Baylor. Like, I grew up my entire life wanting to go to A&M. Texas was actually the first school that came calling. So I was just like, I always hated Texas. And I'm like, all right, I can see myself going there.
Yeah.
That didn't materialize. And at the end of the day, like, Baylor was kind of at the bottom of the list. But this is kind of what I always told people, like, even before I was a believer, even before I really cared about the Lord, I could still feel him, you know, pulling me in that direction. And so I felt like that was the best direction for my career. And so ended up choosing Baylor.
Okay. That's interesting. Sean said the same thing. Said the same thing about, like, always growing up in Aggie.
Yeah, that's right.
And
that's right.
Like,
well, he chased his girl.
That's
there, right?
That's
so
right.
So he chased his girl, but let's go into that. You met your wife there pretty early.
That's right. Your first right? So the story that I tell. I remember seeing her the first day that I stepped foot on campus. So it'd be 25 years ago here in about a month or so, which is really weird that time has gone by that quickly. Yeah. And then I guess probably a few weeks later, she was with a few of her roommates, a few of her friends, and they were looking for another guy in my same apartment complex. And we happened to run into them and just kind of struck up a conversation. And from the very beginning, I could tell there was something just different about her, like different from any girl that I had ever met, on top of just being beautiful. And so that ended up kind of being the group of girls that we started to hang out with. And sure enough, about a month later, we went on our first date. And we did actually break up a few months later for a few weeks or so. But but other than that, that was kind of like the rest is history.
Yeah.
All right. That's great. So, but she was instrumental in leading you to Christ.
She was. So like I said, there was something about her from the very beginning, whether it was a maturity, whatever. You know, even the few meals that we had eaten before together, you know, her and her friends would be like, all right, can we pray before the meal? I was like, all right, that's, it's not like we wouldn't hold hands around the dinner table a little bit growing up and pray from time to time. But out at a restaurant, that was something that was different that I had never really experienced before. Yeah. And then first date at the Olive Garden. And and so we can't be but, I don't know, minutes or really soon into our date. And she's like, can I ask you a question? Like, do you believe that you're a Christian? And then I didn't really think much of it. I didn't really feel cornered. I was just like, well, you know, I grew up going to church. You know, I believe that I'm a good person, simply put, right? Like, there's not much more on top of that. So, yeah, I believe that I'm a Christian. But I wouldn't say that we had like a ton of deep conversations in the coming months, but she would, whether it be invite me to church or I guess a few months later, it was late November. We were about to head home for Thanksgiving break, and she invited me to a Monday night praise and worship service. And that was just really, everything kind of came to a head at that point. Yeah. I'm like, what is it like? And not to mention just being in the culture of Baylor University, going to chapel, being in a different atmosphere and environment that I had ever been in before. I'm like, there's something around me that so much of this student body has that I don't have. And I couldn't quite put my finger on it. It was weird because, like I said, like, I grew up in church. It wasn't the same type of environment. So I think God was just really pulling at my heart there. And because of that, I was acting differently.
Yeah.
And so after the praise and worship, we went to go get coffee, and it was right next to a Pizza Hut. So we're just sitting there in her car in Pizza Hut parking lot. And she, I think on the car ride over there, she's like, are you okay? Like, she noticed that I was acting differently. And so I kind of just started to share like what I was witnessing, what I was feeling. And she took advantage, like she knew that was the moment.
Yeah.
And so, so we just sat there, just the two of us, and she prayed with me to accept Christ.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
How cool is that?
Did you know before you went to Baylor that you were going to be required to go to chapel? Like, were you aware of the environment that you were kind of getting into before you went there?
I knew all of that. So it was kind of, you know, like I said, from a young age, like I knew baseball was it, right?
Right.
And it just, I wasn't opposed to going to chapel. I don't think I was like, I wasn't ready to dive in, you know, completely or jump in with both feet, but I was like, all right, something that I can handle. And a lot of times, like one of my former teammates and I, we would just kind of sit in the back or in the corner and just make fun of the way that the worship pastor prayed or things like that. Like that was kind of the state where I was. Yeah. And so at the end of the day, I was just like, oh, I'll do this if it means, you know, getting an education and, you know, playing baseball at the Division I level. I'm fine with it.
Yeah, sure.
So you actually, before you started your college baseball career, you came to Christ right then. And I think we've talked a little bit in previous podcasts about the kind of the fear that competitive edge goes away or something like. Obviously, it didn't for you. You started as a freshman and then, you know, kind of blew up from there. So did anything change in your competitive psyche, or did you feel more free?
No. And I will say, like, this was the beginning of a very long process.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, when we talk about, you know, Cody Allen talked about it on the podcast that he was on, but talk about the importance of biblical community, because I didn't really have that.
Yeah.
There were some guys on the team that were walking with the Lord, but I wouldn't say that I dug in. I got to know Byron, and I saw him as a resource, but it's not like I frequently attended chapel. So the process of growth from there, like I stayed in the stage of spiritual infancy for a long time. I think more so in my mind, it was, all right, so I can, now I have a true understanding of what it means to get to heaven. So I can choose heaven or I can choose hell. And well, obviously I want to choose heaven. And if I understand that my good works don't get me there, that it's what Christ did on the cross for me, and acknowledging that, like, I can do that.
Right. Yeah.
But in terms of now the Holy Spirit living and working in me, I don't know how obedient I want to be to that. You know, like, I still kind of want to have my cake and eat it too. Like, I can be a Christian and still live this general lifestyle. Yeah. And I wasn't the worst kid, but I definitely wasn't living the life that Christ had called me to, and I wasn't growing, you know, spiritually at the time.
Okay.
It almost sounds like Andrea was your spiritual leader outside of baseball, and now you have baseball, which is kind of an interesting dynamic. And I think that's one of the reasons why you were so instrumental for me and my growth, was because you really brought Jesus into that arena for me for the first time and lived that out and showed me, like, oh, this guy, you can be a Christian and still be a good baseball player at the same time in the same spot. But it's a really unique dynamic when you first come to know Christ, kind of infusing him and letting him operate in that space, but still being, you know, aggressive and still being a dude on the field.
And I got to deliver a commencement speech. Every now and then I've gotten to talk to like high school students. And that's one of the first things I talk about. Like, I want you guys to look in the mirror and I want you to think about letting your faith be your own. Because for those early years, it was really just hanging on her coattails and like, okay, like if you have a tip for me, if you tell me to do something, I'm going to do it.
Right.
But I'm not going to really like lead my heart. I'm not going to really seek this out on my own. Right. You know, my prayer life and, you know, me reading the Bible and understanding that, like, yeah, maybe I'll kind of dig into that from time to time, but it's not going to be you know, something that I pursue on a daily basis.
Gotcha. I think that's and that's interesting, right? Because that's kind of that early dynamic, and infancy's certainly the right term there, which is great. So killed it at Baylor.
I wouldn't even say kill it. Like my first few years were, like you say, my first year was okay for a freshman. I got to play a lot.
Sure,
and that's exactly why I went to Baylor. Yeah. You know, I was just like, these other schools, I don't know if I'm going to get to play right away.
Yeah.
So I trust the coaches here. They seem like a good group of guys that I can really go with their word, other than, you know, the word is the coaches at this school, you may play, you may not.
Yeah.
I went to Cape Cod my first summer. What a great experience playing in top competition in college baseball. Fell flat on my face. I was hitting under 200 most of the summer. I had a good last few weeks. I think I hit like 210 or 215, something like that. No power.
Yeah.
I go back to college the next year. I broke my hamate bone like in the two-a-days leading up to the season. So I missed the first, I don't know, month or so of the season. I come back. I was still feeling it. So I hit probably 150 or so for the next month. And then things finally started to get better. I had a good year at Cape Cod. And then I had two average years. And then I had one extraordinary year my last year to kind of catapult me toward getting drafted.
Yeah. Yeah. Got drafted pretty high by the Red Sox, right? And then what'd you spend, like a few years in the minors?
I spent, I will say, for a first round draft pick, I did not live up to expectations. And I think, so I was a big time like front foot hitter. I was blessed with hands. I could take my hands to the ball, but when the rest of your body is going forward, it's hard to hit a good fastball.
Right.
Yeah. And so I could not, like, they put a wood bat in my hands and I'm facing guys throwing 92 to 95. And so I had a hard time getting that head out.
Yeah.
And so I had some things that I really needed to change, that I had to change. I needed to learn how to hit with my lower half, because I was more of a shift forward, throw my hands at the ball kind of guy. I didn't strike out a lot, but when you're a first round draft pick and you're an outfielder, that, you know, I played center early on, but it was most likely I was going to be a corner outfielder in the future. If you're a corner outfielder, you got to hit for power. And I wasn't really doing that. So it took me a few years to learn how to do it. Finally, things started to pick up in double A, or at least, you know, even if it wasn't over the fence power. I had a year in 2006 where I hit 40 doubles, and that was a good sign of power to come.
Yep.
And then, finally got my first big league call up in 2006.
Okay. And then got traded early 07. Is that right? All right.
Yeah. So I go a cup of coffee with the Red Sox, September 2006. I spend the whole month in the big leagues, and Terry Francona called me in the office from day one. He was just like, I don't know how much you're going to play. Don't plan on playing a ton, but you're up here to gain experience, to rub shoulders with these big league guys, which at the time, you know, Red Sox have always been a veteran group. So we're talking about Manny Ramirez, David Ortiz, Jason Varitek, Kurt Schilling on the pitching side, just so many of these guys that I'm kind of deer in headlights on a daily basis.
And salty dudes
A few guys have mentioned, like, as a rookie, like, you keep your head down, but it was even more so. And with this group, like, you better not you don't step out of line. Like Alex Cora, who is the current manager for the Red Sox, he was on that team.
Yeah.
And Dustin Pedroia, look, who is an absolute gamer. Like, we had a day-night doubleheader at Yankee Stadium. And Dustin Pedroia, he fell asleep on the couch, like, in the middle of the doubleheader. And Alex Cora is just like, hey, rookies you don't sleep in the clubhouse.
Right.
And so, like, it's like not only is it not frowned upon, like, it's welcome to take a nap in the clubhouse these days.
Right.
Like, a lot of these new stadiums, they have sleep pods. Yeah. Right. But Alex Cora is telling Dustin Pedroia, hey, you don't sleep in the clubhouse.
Yeah.
And so you're just kind of like, you're always on edge, like making sure that you don't do anything to accept the flow or disturb the flow and the rhythm of what's going on with these veteran guys.
Were you considered a big prospect? I mean, I know you were a first round draft pick, but you and I've talked about it. You know, you said you didn't exactly light up the minor leagues. When you were called up, were you still considered like a high prospect? Like,
I think there was enough attention on me. People knew who I was, but I'd kind of fallen from grace in terms of that. Like, I was never, you see like the MLB top 100 prospects or whatever, Baseball America. I was never in the top 100 prospects. My first year after I got drafted, I was like a top 5 prospect.
Yeah.
And then after that, I was never a top 10 prospect in my own organization again. So yeah, I had definitely fallen from grace.
So that's a really challenging thing for me to kind of wrap my mind around. And I had to eventually do it with the Rangers in 2011. But I just want you to talk about that a little bit, going from being an everyday player and kind of being the guy in the minor leagues to being called up to the big leagues and having to sit on the bench and still stay ready and for your opportunity. Like, what did that do for your head? Like,
I think I was fine with it early on with the Red Sox, especially.
Yeah.
Because I kind of knew where I was. And I'll say, so this is 2006, the first time I get called up.
Yeah.
Going back to 2005, I was in Double A, and I'm like, I kind of started to like look around, and you start to understand like what it means and what it takes to get to the big league.
Right.
And I look up there, I'm like, all right, you got Manny Ramirez in left field. I am not.
Right. You're not taking his
spot. Not taking that spot.
Was Damon in center field?
So he was early on, and then they had traded for Coco Crisp.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow.
And then in 2006, Trot Nixon was there, who had been there for a long time. But then even after that 2006 season, I'm like, all right, do I have any chance to like break into this outfield? Well, they signed JD Drew to like a 5-year deal. And I'm like, okay, I'm not going to go play right field. So the only chance I have is to try to play better than Coco Crisp.
Yeah.
And, you know, he got off to a great start in his career as a Red Sox. So I'm like, so maybe I can be a fourth outfielder type of guy. Yeah. But we're also talking about a time when teams, they highly valued veteran players and did not value minor league talent.
Right, right.
And in an organization like the Red Sox, you had to put up monster minor league numbers to break in and really be a part of their major league team. And I didn't feel that was going to happen. So I knew my best opportunity to be a big leaguer was in an organization other than the Red Sox.
Yeah. So they fortunately trades you, I guess. And so real quick, timing wise there, when do you get married?
So get married in 2005. That was always kind of part of the plan. So Andrew and I had talked, we dated all through college, and she needed to make plans of her own. Like she considered going to medical school. She changed her major at one point where she was considering going into nursing school. So it was basically like, you know, are we going to get married right away or am I going to go to medical school? Because we can't, like, we've got to do one or the other where, like, I've got to focus on studying and, you know, medical school while I'm there so we can get married now or we can get married after.
Yeah.
It's like, let's do it now. So we get married, basically 2 weeks after she graduates college.
Okay.
I left after my junior year, so she was still there another year and a half. And so we dated and we did the long distance thing through the early years in the minor leagues. And then we get married. So she is with me my first year in Double A and my last few years of my minor league career. And we're married when I get called up to the big leagues.
Okay.
Yeah. So then fast forward, you mentioned the trade. So, fortunately, I do get traded. It's July 31st of 2007. It's the trade deadline. I'm in Columbus, Ohio, and kind of just laying on the couch, no expectations. The Rangers, the Red Sox were competing. They had won the World Series in 2004. They were having a good year in 2007, but they're lacking bullpen depth. The Rangers had signed Eric Gagne to a one-year deal. And so the Red Sox had their eye on Eric Gagne. I'm laying on the couch in Columbus, Ohio. Peter Gammons, ESPN, had a trade deadline special. Peter Gammons said, all right, there's talks about Eric Gagne going to the Red Sox. The Red Sox, the guys that have been mentioned in the possible package are this guy, this guy, this guy, David Murphy. And so I shot up. I'm like, what's going on? Within the coming hours, my phone starts to ring. I get to the field. Like, I'm kind of, like, nervous. I call my wife back home, who is pregnant with our oldest. And which, like, not only pregnant, but, like, set to give birth in coming days.
Real pregnant.
Very pregnant. This is July 31st. She's set to be induced on August 4th.
Oh, wow.
And so so finally, it happens a few hours later. I get a phone call from Scott Service, who was the farm director at the time. And I said, all right, we're, you know, it's official. You're coming to the Rangers. We're, you know, we've heard about you. We're excited to get you. We're going to put you on a flight tomorrow. And I'm like, oh, what? My wife's going to give birth in a few days. Can I hang out here? So I actually hung out for a week in Providence, Rhode Island. We get everything packed up. And so our oldest is born in Boston. We get back to Providence and everything's packed up. I fly out to meet the team in Sacramento, And then I play a few days. I get called up like 3 or 4 days later.
Yeah, yeah.
And my wife, this will give you just, for those listening, if you want a great picture of what it is to be married to a big leaguer, my wife has her first baby, our oldest. And then her mom and her sister come out and they drive Providence, Rhode Island to Texas with a newborn baby.
Nice.
So
your family, your wife is from this area.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that. I mean, for people that don't know a ton about your background.
Yeah.
I was drafted by the team that I grew up watching. So that was awesome, but it was not what I thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. But being in the stage of life that you were in, where you were at with your career, getting an opportunity to come to a team that needs help, but also having your first child, getting to talk about how big of a blessing that was. Like, I mean, that had to be a huge relief.
It was God's providence, 100%. We had talked about over the years, like, how great would it be if we get traded to Texas or to the Astros? Just being home, right?
Yeah.
Being in Texas and being around family. And we actually decided the previous offseason, we had an apartment in Houston, and that was kind of like a trial run. So knowing that she was pregnant, we're like, all right, we need to make a decision, because we kind of lived like the nomadic lifestyle. Like we would live with her parents, with my parents in previous off seasons. But now we're like, okay, we really need to make a decision here. Like it's our time to either buy an apartment, to buy a house, and to really like make some roots here.
Yeah.
And so we choose Dallas. Like Dallas is going to be our home. This is where we're going to live. I get traded to the Rangers.
Yeah.
We're going to be closer to home. It couldn't have worked out better. I'm going to a team with, say, solid leadership and a guy in Michael Young, Ian Kinsler's, you know, a budding prospect that having, you know, a few good years in the major leagues. So it's a team on the up and up a little bit, for sure. But they're not really having a good year.
Yeah.
You got a young manager in Ron Washington, or not young, but a rookie manager, a first year manager in Ron Washington. So I'm home. I'm getting the opportunity to play, and we have our first child. Life is good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who else was in that trade? Because I remember being in the minor leagues, and it was that trade and the Teixeira trade that it was like, oh man, they're trying to win now.
Yeah.
You know? So that was extremely encouraging to me as a minor leaguer who was kind of making his way through the ranks. But who else was in that trade? Was it Kaysen?
Kaysen Gabbard, who we had come up together in the minor leagues, left-handed pitcher, didn't throw very hard. He spotted up. And it was like, it was the opposite for him. Like he loved the guys in Boston. He loved his time there. He had a hard time with the transition. And then Angel Beltre, who was a young prospect at the time, ended up debuting for the Rangers in 2013.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, you come in, it's pretty good. So kind of triumphs and challenges. Where was the good? Where was the challenge?
I guess I could give you like the course of a few years, right?
Yeah.
So 2007, basically everything was great.
Yeah.
You know, I get my time to shine, and I took full advantage of it. Yeah. I'm like, you know, I'm already, I believe I was 25 years old at the time. So for a first round draft pick, I'm getting to the big leagues a little bit later.
Right.
And I'm like, this is like, I'm going to put a stranglehold on this opportunity. So I think I want to say like the, I don't know, the 30 run game that happened
against Baltimore,
like that's right. That was about a week into my Rangers career.
Okay.
And I went like 5 for 7, you know, I was really able to establish myself and get off to a good start. I think I went like 20 for my first 50. So I was hitting 400. I had a 3 for 4 game against Justin Verlander.
Wow.
Like things were going really well. I ended the season hitting 340 something. Still didn't hit for a ton of power. I hit a lot of doubles, but I did enough to establish myself as like, I put myself on the map. If that was a tryout for the next season, then I would say I succeeded. I had a good spring in 2008, made my first opening day roster, got off to a good start. I was the American League Rookie of the Month in April of 2008. I mean, I had some up and down times throughout that season. I guess the big downtime was Pudge was playing for the Yankees, and I had a collision with him in early August, and that ended my season. I partially tore my PCL on the back of my knee, But still, at the end of the day, my numbers were good.
Yeah.
And, you know, going into my second full year, I had no, you know, fear of, you know, that the job wasn't mine. And they, the Rangers held that same mindset.
Yeah.
Sure. I did. You were on the team by then. So, you know, you got called up in early 2008 or mid-June of 2008.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were teammates then. We both had a rough start to the 2009 season.
Yes, we did.
I started the season 0-23, and we were in Baltimore, and we had we actually had, I don't know if you want to call it Bible study. We had some guys just get together. Yeah. You and I were struggling, and just time to spend together with a group of guys. And I remember we got room service and we got a bunch of pieces of chocolate cake.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
This was the big vice.
Yeah.
And so the next day, I mean, this is late April. I mean, I'm hitting zero and I get my first hit, but, that was my first taste of just struggle.
Yeah.
And I had kind of up and down moments. But that was, I don't know. I guess for, you know, listening to Cody and to Sean, like I was fortunate enough to have really a consistent, like I didn't really go up and down. Like you kind of had some up and down moments early on. Like the first 5 years of my major league career, like they weren't all-star caliber by any means, but they were steady. They were consistent. Yeah. They were enough to hold down a major league job. And I played on some really good teams and, you know, got to go to the World Series a few times in the process.
How would you say your faith played a role in that for your first 5 years? I look at your first 5 years and I think about my first 5 years, and we've known each other long enough and are candid enough with each other to know that you were clearly walking with Jesus in those years, and I was struggling to figure out what that meant. So how would you say that really played a role in just the consistency of your everyday preparation, your attitude, like who you were on a daily basis? To me was a very level-headed, a very like... just a very solid believer.
Yeah. I guess it's interesting. Like I knew I came off that way.
Yeah.
And it's not that that wasn't true in some ways, but I feel like God also has to beat you down in a lot of ways to wake you up. And those are really the true moments when you start to grow. And I guess the story I would put to that is that fifth year was my best year.
Yeah.
But the first 2 months were very inconsistent. And I remember it was June 1st. We were in Anaheim. And I specifically prayed that morning. I was on my knees and I'm like, God, like, I feel like for what I'm capable of as a major league player, I'm not living up to that. Yeah. And I would really like to. So I straight up prayed for success. I'm like, God, can you help me to live out, you know, what and to play as that player that I know I'm capable of being?
Right.
And so like, it's kind of funny, like that night I stole second and I kind of went in, like I slid feet first, but the throw was to the inside of the bag. I slide to the outside and grab the bag. I go in thumb first and I broke my thumb.
Yeah.
It was something I could play through. So I played through it and I did okay. But I really started to take off, right?
Yeah.
And it was really interesting. So I go on to have what was the best season of my most consistent season of my major league career.
Yeah.
So going into the 2013 season, I wasn't arrogant, but I was thinking at this in the same way, like I've kind of got this figured out. Like I set a good foundation for the coming years, right?
Yeah.
And like I think I can be a 25 home run guy.
Right.
But the career high to that point, I had 15 that year. I had hit 17 at one point. And the last thing that I really need to add in is the power. So I'm just kind of praying through this.
Right.
But at the same time, going into 2013, I also noticed, I'm like, God, but I think the main thing on my heart is that going into the season, I'm always like spiritually energetic and spiritually strong.
Yep.
And I feel like I always backtrack, you know, toward the end of the season, whether it's the travel, whatever's going on, I'm never in a as good of a place at the end that I was at the beginning.
Yeah.
I said, my prayer that whole spring was like, God, I want to grow spiritually. I want to be stronger on the backside than I am on the front side. So I guess, long story short, God accomplished that.
Yeah.
But I fell flat on my face. Like, what had been the most consistent 5 years? Yeah. Like, And I think I was like a 285 career hitter going into that season. I hit 220.
Yeah.
And I still, the power numbers were okay, but I'm like, man, and the weird thing through all of it, if you've ever, the way I've described it to you, if you've ever seen the movie, The Angels in the Outfield,
yeah.
The first 5 years of my career, I felt like one of those players that there was an angel with me the entire time. Like, I was playing at a level that I never played at in the minor leagues. Like, I was really content with the way that I was playing.
Yeah.
And then, like, I was doing it all on my own, and God was kind of leaving me there saying, you know, like, there were moments where he was reminding me, like, you're capable of this, you can do this, but, like, you're going through this for a reason.
Yeah.
And I knew that the whole time. But there were also, like, through the midst of it, like, I was struggling.
Yeah.
Like, I would drive home from the field, and I'm, like, close to tears. I'm banging on the steering wheel. Yeah. I'm like, God, why are you doing this?
Why are you doing this?
I knew why, but at the same time, like, I didn't want to experience the why.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crossing Home Plate is sponsored by College Baseball Fellowship. College Baseball Fellowship exists to reach college baseball players with the transformative truth of the gospel. Founded on a passion for both the game and the glory of Christ, CBF connects current and former MLB players with collegiate athletes, creating opportunities for mentorship, discipleship, and authentic spiritual growth. If you are a college coach or player and would like our team to visit, or you'd like to support CBF, you can learn more at collegebaseballfellowship.org.
It's crazy when I think back just... And it's not just my career, your career, but I feel like there were so many instances that when I've talked to guys, that it's like you get into a place spiritually to where you're freed up and God allows you to have that success and you get to taste it and you get to see it. And then he kind of reminds you, like, this is not what it's all about.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I did design you with these gifts, with this skill set. And yeah, you are being faithful. But ultimately, like, this is going to end at some point, and this is about me. It's not about you. And so it's almost like a beautiful moment, but man, it is so hard to go through at times.
Yeah.
Like, just the struggle. And I think for me, the biggest challenge was struggling in the spotlight for so long and identifying with Christ and saying that I'm a Christian, but also having the, like, God, why am I doing this? Why are you doing this to me right now? And it's just a challenge. I think that's why it's so huge for especially a younger believer to have guys in their life, guys that they can play with. I can't remember. I think Sean was talking about it, but he said he didn't have that guy in the clubhouse that he could be like, hey man, let me pray for you. And so, man, it's just like, we talk about this community of believers, especially in the game of baseball, man, it is so crucial for young men, to have guys that can pour into them and just kind of show them the way and reassure them, because man, it is such a hard game.
And I will say too, just from listening to previous podcasts or listening to you, like, I was kind of the opposite. Like, I wasn't afraid to, like, speak out about
it.
Like,
right.
I wasn't afraid to stand up to the media and say, like, I know I'm not getting this done, or you know, the guys that were around me say, like, man, I'm struggling with this.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I don't know how to deal with this. Like, I was outspoken about it. And I mean, I guess that helped me to understand the type of community I had and guys that were around me. And maybe at the end of the day, like, that did make it easier, but it didn't feel like it in the process.
Right.
And I think it just made me realize, if anything, like, and something, whether it's in my career or outside of my career, marriage, parenting, life in general, you know, I didn't grow up really dealing with conflict well.
Yeah.
Whether with people or with the best environment for me, like, I think I've come to understand that, like, a huge idol in my life that I have to fight with all the time, I like when the waters are steady, man.
Yeah.
Like, I like comfort.
Yeah.
And so whether that's relational or whether that's work related, like, you know, we ride this wave throughout the season, right?
Yeah.
In terms of our level of success personally, and we want that to be here as much as possible. Like, if it's here, that's great too.
Right.
But we definitely don't want it to be here.
Yeah.
And if we're here, we try, like, let's try to steady these waters as much as possible in all forms of life.
Yeah.
Because when things get disrupted, like, I go a little haywire.
Yeah.
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 you made me think of Peter, like, get out of the boat, and then I'm fine as long as the water's calm. But then I start looking around at the storm, and you take your eyes off of Jesus, and it's like, I mean, it 100%. Just shows you how important it is to be locked in and plugged in all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that community around you, you had some in the locker room, yeah. You had maybe some outside, you obviously had your wife, and what was kind of the, I mean, who'd you have around you? What, and it doesn't necessarily have to be names, but kind of who was around you, who was helpful through the struggles, you know, what was the challenge? Because, hey, sometimes marriage isn't easy,
yeah,
in the struggle, right?
I would say just, you know, a guy I remember that I could lean into was Craig Gentry. Like, he was kind of a young believer. And then even a guy like Lance Berkman, he was older. He was, like, he was kind of done with baseball. Like, his body was starting to fail him. But, you know, he was a guy that was unfiltered. He is the most, you know, in terms of just theological wisdom and intelligence, the best I ever played with. Like, oh, he was incredible. So we would have moments like that. Jose Vasquez, our strength and conditioning guy. I mean, Jose, like, he called me in the office in like June or July, and he's just like, hey, this isn't something that I would normally do. He's like, I just want to give you a heads up. Like, they're starting to give up on you a little bit. Like, yeah. You know, I want you to keep your head down and keep working because, you know, like, you could lose playing time. So, you know, guys like that, even though that's tough news, like, it helped that there was a guy like that in my corner who there was nothing he could do to really fight for me. But he was trying to help to open my eyes, which, I mean, I was understanding that the whole time. Like, I'm like, man, like, when is the day that I'm going to get called in the office and they're going to tell me, like, we've got to go? And it eventually happened in early September. And I was just like, I'm doing everything that I can every day to figure this out and work in the cage. And that was kind of one of those moments that I told you that God kind of gave me an example. Like, I'm still here.
Right.
Like, I hit a big time home run that day.
Yeah.
And then I still, you know, from there, it was kind of nothing. But so there were moments, there were guys around me, but I think if anything, we tend throughout the course of a season, it's easy to be self-focused, right?
100%.
And I think that's one of the things that God showed me that season. I'm like, whether I'm playing, whether I'm not playing, whether I'm having a few days where I'm succeeding, or whether I'm riding this roller coaster where I'm struggling hard for the first time, God is kind of showing me that my focus needs to be elsewhere on my teammates, and I need to focus on being a good teammate rather than sulking over there in the corner and just wallowing in self-pity.
Yeah,
sure. Yeah, so, I mean, at that time, you're, what, approaching 30, somewhere in that range?
I was 31 at the time, I believe.
Okay,
yeah.
So still pretty young in your walk, the first 13 years or something?
Yep.
At that point. So did you feel a progression in your walk through that time? And were there certain habits that, and maybe disciplines that you had, you know, in the off season that were hard to carry through the season, that, you know, was that a piece where you saw the leakage, if you will, in your walk?
I don't know if I quite understood how to be a leader. Like, you know, like I appreciate, and just the way that my spiritual journey played out, like, I'm kind of, you know, everybody says that you need to be in your Bible. So I did my best to do that. I mean, I was pretty consistent with it, and be in prayer. So if those are, you know, two of the foundational aspects of what it is to have a good spiritual life, have a relationship with the Lord, and grow spiritually, like, I feel like I was doing those things, whether it was, in 2013 for sure, during the season, then in the off season, then I signed a 2-year deal with Cleveland.
Yeah.
And that was kind of like, it was kind of like when you graduate high school, you go into college and you're like, all right, if everybody's known me as this for a long time, I can go into college and I can kind of reinvent myself.
Right.
And it wasn't that wasn't who I was, but that was what I was intentional. Like, when I went into Cleveland, I was almost forceful with the way that I wanted to be one of the guys that mentored me, Darian Mellon. He was our spring training chaplain.
Yeah.
And I would have so many conversations with him, and he'd be like, yeah, I hear what you're saying. Like, you want to be the God guy on your team, or John Spicer, you know, like I was always uncomfortable praying amongst other guys, but I wanted to be a leader, right? I wanted to be that guy.
Yeah.
And so he asked in chapel every week, like from the very beginning. And he was kind of a rookie as being a chaplain when I started with the Rangers.
Yeah.
And he would always be like, all right, does anybody want to open us up in prayer? And so over the first few chapels, I'm like, oh, this is something that I want to do, but I don't feel confident in doing it.
Yeah.
So that was kind of like one step. Yeah. I'd be like, all right. So I got to the point where I'm like, I'm gonna raise my hand every week because I know I've got to do something uncomfortable like this, you know, to be better at it. And so that was one area, but it's just kind of goes back to like my dad in baseball, like my entire life growing up, he's like, be a leader.
Yeah.
but nobody really along the way ever said like, this is how you lead.
Right.
And nobody ever intentionally like took me under their wing and showed me like, this is what this looks like. So, you know, I remember just doing my best.
Yeah.
When I went to Cleveland, I'm just like, all right, I'm gonna, you know, part of what was under my contract is like, I get a suite on the road, and I'm I get not only this room, but I get this living room. I'm like, what better opportunity to just invite guys into my room and have a Bible study. I didn't even know really how to do that or what that looked like, but I would have guys, and you know, UPI has been mentioned. UPI had an app, that they would kind of like talk to guys on just material to go through, and there was questions. So I would lead guys through that at times and do it still like the whole time. I'd be like, I don't really feel equipped for this.
Right,
I don't really, you know, exactly know what I'm doing. I just know that I want to try to do this. Yeah. I want to try to be a leader. And so that was kind of what I tried to continue throughout the rest of my career.
Yeah.
I don't know quite how successful I was, but I think God saw my heart in it at the same time.
And your willingness too. I think that's a big key is, I went through the same leadership thing, excuse me, that you did. It's to where I always a lead by example guy. And I remember sitting in a chapel, the chaplain's name is Bland. We were in Boston, and the chapel was literally on, what type of leader are you? You know, is it like, are you lead by example? Are you a vocal leader? And I felt a pull on my heart for God saying like, you need to be more vocal.
Right.
But there's accountability that comes with your words. So it's like, man, if I'm going to sit here and say like, we need to be doing this and we need to be, I have to be doing these things. So it's like, to your point, like I didn't really know how to lead, but I knew that God was calling me to lead in a different way.
Yeah.
And I want to go back to something that you said, because you and I have talked about this and I just kind of want to get your thoughts. I felt like every off season leading into spring training, my tank was full. Mm-hmm. You know, I had gone to church in the off season. Jill and I had time together. We had done Bible studies with other believers who were baseball players. And so you get to spring training and you're like, I'm fired up. You know, like I'm fired up for the season. Spiritually, I'm on fire. And you usually have pretty good Bible studies in spring training because you're for the most part, you still have a good amount of time with your family.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of get like more of a 9-to-5 schedule as opposed to like the 7 to midnight schedule.
Right.
But then you get into the season, and I don't know if it's just the environment that you're in, the fact that you are around a lot of other guys that are not believers who are not living those kinds of lives, even some believers who are living some questionable lives, or just the like, the fact that you're immersed in this very like worldly environment on a day-to-day basis, and it's broadcast in front of your face on TV. And
mm-hmm.
How important is it to continue, like you talked about that, the going to Cleveland and that being your opportunity to kind of take that leadership role. How important is it to just stay plugged in and to have those Bible studies and to have even maybe some people outside of your baseball group who can pour into you, especially for like a young player who's trying to figure the game out too?
Yeah, it's almost like, and I always mess this up every time I say it, but it's like, show me your five best friends or the five people closest to you, and you're kind of like the sum or the average of those five guys, right? Yeah. And when you're spending so much time around guys that typically aren't like-minded,
yeah,
and you don't really so much of the season, I mean, you're spending more time around them than you are your family, and you don't necessarily have a choice who your right. teammates are. When you're home, you get to be around your family. It's a little bit of a refresher there, but yeah. you spend so much time in the clubhouse, and there's so much that you just, in a lot of ways, that you just have to avoid. So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and kind of, I talked about my spiritual journey in the beginning of it at Baylor, and that, yeah. I think that's a big part. I mean, obviously I'm not saying like, well, it's their fault because they didn't rally. Like, obviously there's a responsibility that each of us have to take that and run with it and to grow. But if you can surround yourself with the right people,
yeah,
that's obviously going to expedite the process. Yeah. It's going to help the process be way more consistent.
Yeah. I think back to, as I was an older player, the last few years of my career, and I regretted opportunities that I didn't take advantage of to go have, you know, a beer with a guy. Like, you don't have to go out and get tore up, but like, there were opportunities for maybe me to connect with my teammates. And I stood back, 'cause I'm like, I don't want to say, Hey babe, I'm going to go hang out in the bar for a few yeah. hours. But I think that when we think of just the journey that, Jesus had, like his walk, like he spent time with people in there, like he met them where they were at,
right?
And so as a guy who played a while and had the opportunity to maybe witness to some guys, that's something I would encourage guys to do. I'm not saying you have to put yourself in an environment where you're yeah. going to be tempted and maybe like pressured to give into that temptation, but don't be afraid to enter, to go meet somebody where they're at, you know.
That's a really good point. And I think, like, I think if I could do my career over again from a relational standpoint, there's a lot of things that I would change.
Yeah.
I think the fact that I knew that I was young spiritually, there was a lot of energy and a lot of excitement there.
Yeah.
But I also, in a lot of ways, maybe either I didn't trust myself
yeah.
or it was very fear-based.
Right.
You know, and that's the thing, too. Like, leading by example can be a really good thing.
Yeah.
But I think it can also like keep you into yourself a little bit
yeah.
and you know, it can lack an outward focus
yeah.
because it can be like, well, I'm going to do my thing and I'm going to show you guys like the right way to do it and I'm going to be that example, but it kind of lacks in a lot of ways the hey yeah. man, like come with me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, let me show you how to do this. Like, it lacks that element yeah. of leadership, right? And I think I was watching the what is it, Swamp Things or Swamp something?
Swamp People.
It was Tim Tebow. Like, it was
the
story of like Florida football yeah. back in the day, and Tim Tebow obviously was a big part of it.
Yeah.
And it would talk about like him, like part of like some of his stories would be like talking about going to lunch or going to dinner with guys.
Yeah.
It's not like I never did that, but I kind of had a personal rule, and my wife Andrea and I talked about like, all right, I'll go to breakfast or I'll go to lunch with guys, but like after games
yeah.
and once the sun goes down,
yeah.
I'm not going to go hang out with guys because I don't want to put myself in a compromising place. And there's a lot of health in that boundary,
100%,
right?
Like, yeah.
There's a lot of good things to that. But at the same time, like, I just feel like I could have, when it comes to discipleship, which I've learned so much about on the opposite side of retiring, on the opposite side of my career,
yeah.
I could have done a way better job when it comes to discipleship throughout the course of my career.
Right. Same yeah. for me.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, I would put in a protection like that too.
Yeah.
You know, we've got rules between my wife and I. Hey, yeah. we don't enter into lunches and different things like that in the business world, you know, super careful with things like that.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a ton of wisdom in there. And at the same time, God's going, hey, I'm going to use your silliness, your, you know, your trip over yourself, theology or whatever yeah. along the way. And what's funny is it'll turn around and all of a sudden you go, wait a minute, I actually had an impact on that guy.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that. And I think that was the beauty. Like when Carp and Chris went into TCU a little bit ago, just being able to go in a room and go, hey, we weren't you know, we didn't have it all together right. during that time. And to get in those locker rooms and have those conversations, guys, hey, these guys are stumbling. They're going through all the junk that you're going through, went through it. And yeah. I mean, it's through that struggle. And I think about, you know, even like, hey, Moses going, hey, I don't know how to talk.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And very much going, I got you. Don't yeah. worry about that.
Oh, man. All those things. You can see like throughout the pages of the Bible, like why God created these men that right. are infallible, you know, like
just messed up
that just, that they stumble time and time again, whether it's David, whether it's Paul, whether it's Moses, God's giving us that encouragement. The story of Job,
holy cow,
things taken away from him. It's incredible the way that God has given us these examples of real life to show us that, like, we are, like, Moses didn't feel equipped, you know, right. Paul, like, so many of us, like, I mean, I immediately thought, oh, I'm going to accept Christ, so, like, life is going to be good, it's going to be steady,
right?
When, like, that's the prosperity gospel, right? And it's just the opposite. What is it? Second Corinthians, where Paul's like, well, I've been shipwrecked and I've been snake bitten and I've been beaten, you know, like he's kind of like showing us, like, it really doesn't get any worse than what I've been through. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then, I think you mentioned it on one of the podcasts with the guys like David, like through his struggle and just the way that he communicates with God in the Psalms. And he's just like, redeem me for the sake of your steadfast love. Like, and there's exclamation points all throughout the passage. Yeah. And I'm like, that's really interesting. And I'm like, I can't believe that David would come before God. But I think if David is a man after God's own heart, you know, throughout the pages of Scripture, like, he's giving us an example that we can be raw and we can come before God with, right. like, with our raw emotion and what we're feeling.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point, too. And I think we live in a day and age where everybody's so offended by everything. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, for me, it's almost the perfect time to wear your faith on your sleeve, because you're going to piss somebody off.
Yeah.
Like, regardless of what you stand for. Like, yeah. People are just waiting in line and a lot of times the people that criticize Christianity so hard are Christians.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, if ever there was a time to really wear your faith on the sleeve, I feel like now you have the freedom to do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's challenging when you have to devote so much time to the game of baseball. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you operate and I want to be a good Christian, but I also know that God has called me into this arena for now, and this is my mission field. So how do I continue to be faithful with that? But it's just, it's a challenge, man. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge. You know that just as well as anybody.
Yeah, no, it's, I don't know. And there's ways, like, it's so easy to think that the world sees, like, you know, this perfectly put together, that this is what a Christian is. And, instead of having those raw feelings, those raw emotions, the struggles that so many people have. And so I think that's kind of an interesting way to navigate that and show, like, you can be fierce and you can be a competitor and you can, like, you can be all of those things all at the same time. You know, I'm referring to past podcasts, you know, again and again, but there was one talking about just general blowups. And, there was one in Cleveland that was funny because, like there were so many, I played with guys, you probably did too. Like, every single time they got out, hear something blowing up behind the dugout. Right. And there was one particular, I went through a stretch in Cleveland where I was 1-for-44. Like, I went like 0-for-22. I got a hit, and then I went like 0-for-21.
Ouch.
And that was one of the hardest times. And somewhere in the midst of that, like, I was just like, I need to just get this stress off my shoulders. Yeah. And so I went in the back and, like, I took a bat to like a helmet rack or something that. Like, I didn't cuss. I didn't, you know, like, it wasn't like a typical blow up that you might hear audibly.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But it was funny because I come back up and, like, my teammates, I think that they pointed out, like, they know the usual suspects, right?
Right, right.
And they're like, well, if you're here and you're here and you're here, like, who's down there?
No way, it's Murph.
And so I walked back up and everybody's head is looking at me. And, like, there were some smirks and, like, even, like, I think I actually smirked a little bit. Yeah. And I don't know, maybe you could call that I don't know. Like, I don't feel like I was out of control. Like, I just needed to alleviate some stress. Like, I needed to get it off my shoulders for a minute, and then it was done. Right. Yeah. Like, it was over. I wasn't going to carry it.
Yeah.
But man, like it, and I felt better after. Yeah. Like,
you do. I mean, people used to like egg me on all the time to snap my bat over my knee. And I'm like, I'm not doing this to like show a feat of strength. Like, I'm genuinely pissed off right now, and I don't want to swear, and I don't want to blow anybody else up, so I'm just going to take this out. And it was like, it got to be a feat, you know, like a dance monkey, like, come on, we know you're mad. And it was, but it was one of those things where it's like, and you know this, early on in my career, I did not deal with frustration very well. Like, I was a hothead. Yeah. I mean, I think that's easy to say. And as I got older, and as I realized that I had more eyes on me, and guys that, you know, had not been in the big leagues as long as I was, and I would kind of was thrust into that veteran role, and was a believer. And I'm like, okay, well, I don't want to show these guys this, but there is, to your point, like, you can't carry that with you, because if you, it just makes you miserable. It made me a miserable person to like try to hold it all in and act like I had it together. Like, it would come out in other areas of my life, and it wasn't like I was going home and like wearing Jill out or anything like that. But even I think she could tell, like, you're carrying this and you need to let go. So, yeah. I mean, not to encourage guys to blow up bat racks or anything like that, but there's a healthy way to get rid of that anger and to get rid of that frustration. And like, you don't have to carry that, you know, and like, your teammates are not going to judge you for that. Like, they're, a lot of times they know, they feel for you. And I remember having conversations with my teammates about like, how are you holding this all in right now? Like, it's almost like they wanted me to release it. You know, like, it's almost like they felt pity for me. And so it's like, you can't, like, I'm not saying, like, I was always very conscious on the field of cussing because there were kids and there were women. And a lot of times, you know, where we were playing, my family was there. So I didn't want them to see that. But it's okay to be human. And especially in the heat of battle, like, don't beat yourself up, guys, if you blow up. Like, it's part of it, unfortunately.
Yeah, I guess that's the whole dealing with emotions that guys don't do incredibly
exactly.
Well,
and just 100%
learning how to process that over time.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the beauty of, again, we'll go back to David and the Psalms of, hey, I can bring that stuff to God in a way that I think for the longest time I didn't understand at all. And there used to be this language in the church that was always, hey, I got to get right with God.
Yeah.
And it always felt like, oh crap, I got to clean myself up before I can go reach out to God. What a just terrible, just horrible message of, I mean, God's on the other side going, hey, no, just come in.
Yeah.
And I think the more, and you guys being parents now, and the further you get along, the more you realize that the way God looks at you.
Yeah.
As, hey, there's a, man, I want you more than anything to come on in. And when you screw up, which we're doing probably today,
right?
I want to bring you in. And that's the piece that I think, especially early Christians, a lot of times, I think we really struggle with that.
Yeah.
And then I feel like growing up in the churches I did and things like that, it took a long time to understand that.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, what I'd encourage the guys as much as anything is, hey, dive into the Psalms. Yeah. I mean, that's who David is. And what God says about David, man, go jump into those. Yeah. And that would translate outside of baseball for sure, right? Because we're all in the same place where we're going, man, I got to work harder, whatever it is. And then we're coming around going, ah, I screwed up, or I'm frustrated with this or that.
Yeah. So,
or even Ecclesiastes. Like, one of the best turning points of my career toward the end was, like, I had never read Ecclesiastes before. And so it was a devotional I was doing that talked a little bit about it. And I'm like, all right, so you're telling me that this guy Solomon is known to be the wisest guy in the Bible. And he's talking about all of these things that, like, he had it all.
Yeah,
right. He's talking about all the things that he's had, that he was chasing. And he's talking about all of them as meaningless and toil and, you know, chasing after the wind. And that really put me at such peace because like the year before that was kind of, so I told you about 2013, 14 was mediocre. There was some good, there was some bad, but I was going into the last year of my contract knowing it could be the last year of my major league career. And I'm like, you know what? I just want to enjoy this. Like, I don't want all this to pile up on me. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, basically what I took away from it is just like everything that I've chased, you know, so much of what I've chased, it's just at the end of the day, it's meaningless.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm going to go prepare well, and I'm going to, you know, do the best that I can throughout the course of this season, you know, watch video, study the game, you know, be the best player I can be. And if it's good enough for my team that day, then great. And I'll be happy to contribute. But if it's not, like, I can take some, you know, I can be content in that. Yeah. And kind of, there's a story that I tell with that too. The fact that we were in San Diego in 2012, I guess you were in Baltimore by then, but, you know, every first game of the series was early batting practice.
Yep.
And so, we're in San Diego. It's the first time I had ever played there. Kind of looking out at the ballpark, it's really informal. You know, you put shorts on, you know, it's optional. Guys can be there. They, you know, they don't have to be there. And Ron Washington is standing, there was another player or two, but there's just a few of us standing out there in a group talking baseball. And we're looking at the numbers on the top of the scoreboard, all the retired numbers.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, there's Tony Gwynn, and maybe Trevor Hoffman was retired at that point. But I'm like, all right, I think it was like maybe it was number 20 or something. I'm like, who's it's like, I don't know that number. And Wash was like, oh, that's it's Randy Jones. And I'm like, I don't know who that is.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, oh, it's a little lefty. He won the Cy Young back in the day. And like, I considered myself to like be pretty good with baseball history and baseball knowledge, right? But this guy won the Cy Young back in the 70s.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I'm getting ready for the game a few hours later, getting my uniform on, and I'm about to go out on the field, and Wash is on the opposite corner of the clubhouse, and he's like, hey, Murph. And I look over, he's like, this is Randy Jones. So we're cracking up. But I'm like, all right, this guy won the Cy Young back in the day, and for a guy like me who knew the game pretty well, like, this guy went under my radar and forgotten. So me, who was an average player, you know, like, you constantly, it's easy to think when you're a player that the world kind of revolves around Major League Baseball, and in a lot of ways you.
Yeah.
And that was another Berkman comment that he told me. Like, I think I had texted him or had a phone call with him, like, because he retired after that 13th season.
Yeah.
And he was like, it's amazing the amount of people, once you're out of the game, like, you realize how many people don't care about baseball.
Don't even pay attention to it.
And so I'm like, man, like, when I am out of this game, like, I am going to be quickly forgotten. Like,
yes.
I was pretty much an average player throughout the course of my career.
Yeah.
And so, like, yeah, for the most part, like, people may remember that are big Rangers fans. Oh man, that guy played on, you know, a few of the best teams in the history of the franchise or things like that. But when I consider the guys that I rubbed shoulders with and that I played against, and I was fortunate to play with a lot of good ones. Yeah. Like, I'm pretty much going to go under the radar and be forgotten quickly. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Well, we're almost out of time. Tommy Nelson at Denton Bible Church used to tell his ministry guys, take a bucket of water, fill it up, put your hand in there. And then when you pull it out, that's how much you're remembered after. Tommy was tough on people.
Yeah. I like it though.
Yeah.
But it's the hole that's left there. That's how much you're going to be remembered.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's just it's the truth. I mean, there's a reason that you guys have this platform, and it's awesome, and we should use it as best we can to talk to others. But again, like you guys say, you're going to be a former baseball player a lot longer than your baseball player.
Yeah.
So, thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark.
Appreciate
it, guys.
All right.